This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we bring you a number of extensive updates.
An especially exciting week. Mass surveillance may be going down, Edward Snowden issuing heroic statements, and a holiday message and birthday of Chelsea Manning.
We talk with attorney Chase Madar on the over-policing of America.
You may not realize it, but every area of your life and others is now subject to criminal prosecution and police.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, there are some good things, victories really, on the NSA stuff. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, no, it was interesting. You know, after the NSA mass data surveillance was revealed by Edward Snowden, which is particularly the program that takes in all our, quote, metadata, every single phone call made by everybody in the United States, where they are, the length of their calls, who else they're calling, they have it all. And then they keep it in their files, and then they go through it and find out whatever they want to do to build trees of our associates, et cetera. That was challenged. It's been challenged a number of times now in the last few months. And recently we had the first victory in a district court in Washington, D.C., the decision was made by Judge Leon of the District Court in Washington, D.C., and he hasn't been a good judge for Guantanamo. We've lost basically every case before Judge Leon. He's a conservative judge, and yet in this case, in a challenge by two conservatives, as it happens, but there's a number of other cases out there, he ruled flatly, well, not flatly because it's on a preliminary injunction, which you don't actually have to go to the final merits, but he ruled it's more likely than not, or it's likely, that the NSA metadata program of taking all our cell phone information is unconstitutional, and he gave what's called a preliminary injunction against the program, which means it should stop immediately, at least with regard to these two guys, but it really, these two plaintiffs. But then he stayed that decision pending the appeal, but he's pretty severe about it. And what's the most interesting thing about that decision, it's a district court, so there's obviously appeals to the D.C. Circuit and then to the Supreme Court, and it'll probably go there, because the issue is this. In 1979, in a case called Smith v. Maryland, the Supreme Court ruled that when I make a phone call and the phone company has a record of my phone number that I call, that because it's a third party, it's not me holding on to that phone number, but the phone company has that phone number, that that phone number is not protected by the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. The Fourth Amendment is only personal to the person who has the phone. And so they ruled that you could just get phone numbers from the phone company. So when you have your information at third parties, the Supreme Court basically says you have no Fourth Amendment protection against unreasonable searches and seizures. That's true of phone records. That's true of bank records. You know, when we give our information to a bank, our bank account, it's held by a third party, we don't really have Fourth Amendment protections. That's Smith v. Maryland. And then what happened is the technology way advanced beyond anything imagined in 1979. So that it's not just saying, oh, Michael Smith's phone records we want from the telephone company. Now they're saying, well, if you don't have a right, we can take everybody's phone records from everything. And that's what they started to do, and then build this huge mosaic of what Michael Smith does, who he calls, does he have an affair, everything. They can find everything, what his medical problems are, every single thing by who you phone. So at that point, Judge Leon is faced with the Supreme Court precedent saying there's no Fourth Amendment protection for records held by third party. But he also said it's different because now they're building these huge mosaics, and that's very different than taking the individual phone records of one person. And he said, therefore, I think it's likely this ability of the NSA, which has been upheld, let me just say, upheld by 15 different judges in the secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, upheld by that court, he said, I think it's likely unconstitutional. And I think that's just the opening shot. He's a conservative judge. It could be a death knell for this kind of metadata. It'll be really interesting to see. The next court it goes up to is the D.C. Circuit. Now, the D.C. Circuit is the most important circuit appeal court in the United States. Because it's in Washington, it gets all the government cases, all the regulatory cases. And up until about 2 weeks ago, it was divided 4-4 on active sitting judges. And what I mean 4-4 is 4 conservatives and 4 what we would have won, you know, we can call them moderately liberal at this point, maybe. But it was 4-4. So on Guantanamo, we've gotten killed in that court because the conservative judges were sitting on the panels, and we've gotten killed. But now, because of what recently happened in the Senate, where they abolished the filibuster, at least for purposes of presidential appointments, 4 nominations, not 1, not 2, not 3, but 4 nominations of Obama went through of Democrats, or at least on the liberal side of the line. And now you're talking about a court that is 7-4. And one of the reasons the Republicans were so adamant about not adding judges is because they didn't want to ruin that balance of 4-4. Will it revolutionize the world? No. But will it conceivably mean that this district court judge's opinion in the NSA spying case will be upheld? I think it's very, very possible, depending on how the panels get chosen, et cetera. We can go into more on that. But suffice it to say for now that that court in the D.C. Circuit may well be on its way to changing and upholding this decision. Now, Michael, I know that there was a reaction from Ed Snowden to the NSA decision, and why don't you just read us? It's a short reaction, but it's an important one.
Snowden said the following about the decision. Today, a secret program authorized by a secret court was, when exposed to the light of day, found to violate Americans' rights. It is the first of many. That's what Snowden said. And then he went on to say, when he did his revelations, I acted on my belief that the NSA's mass surveillance programs would not withstand a constitutional challenge and that the American public deserved a chance to see these issues determined by open courts. Well, we're getting to see it.
We are getting to see it. So we're in the middle of a deep struggle over control of the Internet, information, secrecy, and people who are trying to take on the state. Very, very important struggle. In terms of that struggle, Michael and I both noticed that on December 17th, Edward Snowden wrote a, quote, open letter to the people of Brazil. We'll post a link to it on our site. I just want to say it's an extraordinary, extraordinary letter. And Michael will read us a couple of paragraphs, and then this Michael Ratner will alternate a bit with Michael Smith.
Well, this is what Edward Snowden says the day after the NSA surveillance stuff was ruled unconstitutional in D.C. And the next day, on December 17th, Snowden said, he wrote a long open letter to the people of Brazil. Initially, he said, at the NSA, I witnessed with growing alarm the surveillance of whole populations without any suspicion of wrongdoing, and it threatens to become the greatest human rights challenge of our time.
This is Michael Ratner. Snowden went on to say, my act of conscience began with a statement. I don't want to live in a world where everything that I say, everything I do, everyone I talk to, every expression of creativity or love or friendship is recorded. Michael Smith?
And then he made this observation, and this is the most cogent thing that Snowden can teach all of us. But let me put it in context. He went on to say the following. American senators tell us that Brazil should not worry because this is not surveillance, it's data collection. They say it is done to keep you safe. They're wrong. There is a huge difference between legal programs, legitimate spying, legitimate law enforcement, where individuals are targeted based on a reasonable, individualized suspicion, and these programs of dragnet mass surveillance that put entire populations under an all-seeing eye and save copies forever. And this is what he said that I think is the most cogent thing that he can teach all of us. He said, these programs were never about terrorism. They're about economic spying, social control, and diplomatic manipulation. They're about power.
You know, I want every person who thinks or believes the justification by the powers in this country that this is about terrorism to just emblazon that statement that Michael Smith read and that Ed Snowden wrote. Economic spying, social control, and diplomatic manipulation. They're about power. And what we have said, this is Michael Ratner talking on this program, that this massive spying program is really about the continuation of empire, an empire that is perhaps declining. And that's what Snowden is saying here. They're about power. Before Michael reads the last paragraph of the letter, I want to say one other thing. Snowden also said in the letter that he's been asked for his assistance in the investigation of suspected crimes against Brazilian citizens. He's been asked that by senators in Brazil. And what he says in the letter, again showing what a strong, forceful personality he is, quote, "I have expressed my willingness to assist whenever appropriate and lawful. But unfortunately, the United States government has worked very hard to limit my ability to do so, going so far as to force down the presidential plane of Evo Morales to prevent me from traveling to Latin America. Until a country grants permanent political asylum, the U.S. government will continue to interfere with my ability to speak." Michael Smith, how did he conclude the letter?
"If Brazil hears only one thing from me, let it be this. When all of us band together against injustices and in defense of privacy and basic human rights, we can defend ourselves from even the most powerful systems."
We've had the NSA victory, we've had two Ed Snowden statements, a particularly strong one around Brazil, and now we're going to close this segment on surveillance, etc., with reading a couple of excerpts from a Christmas card we received from Chelsea Manning, and it reprints some of a statement that he's made before. We'll read two of the paragraphs. Michael Smith, this is again a Christmas card from Chelsea Manning, which is lovely because it has pictures of Chelsea Manning as a child, growing up, in the soldier uniform, in a soccer uniform, it looks like. Quite a lovely card saying season's greetings. Michael, why don't you tell us what he says to us, at least in the first paragraph of that letter, about season's greetings.
He says, "I'm usually hesitant to celebrate Thanksgiving Day. After all, the Puritans of the Massachusetts Bay Colony systematically terrorized and slaughtered the very same Pequot tribe that assisted the first English refugees to arrive at Plymouth Rock. So perhaps, ironically, I'm thankful that I know that. And I'm also thankful that there are people who seek out and usually find such truths."
And I'll end with this, although it's a longer card, and perhaps you can get it and go to the Manning website, and maybe some of it's printed there. I think it may be. Quote, "I'm also grateful for having social and human justice pioneers who lead through action and by example, as opposed to directing or commanding other people to take action." What a great statement. Oh, my gosh. Saying, do it. Don't just tell other people to do it. "Often, the achievements of such people transcend political, cultural, and generational boundaries. Unfortunately, such remarkable people often risk their reputations, their livelihood, and all too often, even their lives." Well, Chelsea Manning, on this Christmas holiday season, we wish you the best and a speedy release from the oppressive hand of our own government, the United States, and we thank you for your incredible courage in the face of the terror of this country.
She's fighting all of our battles from inside a prison cell. The front of the season's greeting cards that she personally signed and sent out says, "Please help us continue the battle to free American prisoner of conscience, Private Chelsea Manning, in 2014.
That incredible statement that you heard Michael Smith and myself, Michael Ratner, read, just remember, it was written by a person who turned 26 on December 17th. Imagine the courage that she had when she was in her 20s, early 20s, to take on the state. So she needs our support, as do all other truth tellers, whistleblowers, and all other prisoners.
And they're not the only ones. Julian Assange, Jeremy Hammond, David Gilbert,
Barrett Brown,
Lynn Stewart,
Mumia Abu-Jamal. We can make a very long list. We urge you to support our political prisoners and others all over the world.
The Obama administration has granted fewer pardons and clemency than any other administration, including the Bush administration. He goes down to South Africa, he pays tribute to Mandela, and he comes back here, and what does he do? Let's help him do the right thing. There's been some interesting news on Guantanamo. Fill us in.
Well, there's a little bit of movement back and forth. I mean, the first thing that strikes me was what's going on at the commissions, which are trying the so-called Guantanamo Five, who were tortured and waterboarded, but who supposedly were in the conspiracy on 9/11. And, you know, I read it, and the trials are such a complete, utter charade. It's hard to believe that anybody can take it seriously. I mean, they've been going on now for many, many years. And the latest thing that has come up is this issue of, can you classify someone's memory? And as I think we've talked about here, these guys were tortured. They were waterboarded. They've told their lawyers, but the lawyers can't speak out. They're under protective orders. And they want to be able to tell the world, which they should be able to, or even testify about it, of what happened to them when they were tortured. And so far, their memories are actually classified, and not just about do they know a code. They're classified on being tortured by the United States, because that supposedly will disclose, what do they call it, Michael, sources and methods, which is ridiculous. So lately, there's been some rulings around that issue, and one of the rulings, a very ambiguous ruling, we can't tell what it means, appears to say they might be, and it's not clear, be allowed to testify to their torture in a closed session of the court, where you and I, Michael Smith and Michael Ratner and our listeners, will not be able to hear what happened to them when they were waterboarded, or how it felt to be waterboarded 183 times, or have some insect put in a coffin-like thing with you that you're terrified in, or have yourself wallboarded, which is thrown up against the wall. We won't hear that, but perhaps it may happen in closed session that they can testify to it. But just think about it, where we've come. We actually can classify people's memories about how they were tortured by their own government. I mean, can you make it up? Can you make up Pinochet? Can you make up the military government in Argentina? Whatever you want to say, this is how low it's become. Then at the trial this week, it's just this, you know, sporadic show, charade. One of the defendants starts complaining. He said, I've been making complaints. I can't sleep at night. They're harassing me with noise all night, all the time. What's going on in the prison has been just outrageous. And the judge throws him out of the court and says, have your lawyers make a motion, you know, which means to say, have them apply to the court, which is meaningless. This has been going on since the guy has been there after being tortured. So, and then these are called military commissions, which are, of course, made up. There's no such thing that should have ever happened in these cases. But this is going on while we're sitting in New York, and you're sitting wherever you are listening to this, and we're going through essentially, call it just a military charade, show trial, kangaroo court. It's outrageous. So that's Guantanamo 1. Guantanamo 2 is apparently after the hunger strike, which happened in the early part of this year, February through April, May, when it was the most intense, the hunger strike of the 162 people left at Guantanamo. Obama made a speech that he would start to close the place. Nothing happened for a number of months, and he still hasn't sent anybody to Yemen, of which there's 80 people who could go to Yemen tomorrow. 60 of them have been cleared by our own government, and they still remain there. But they have now sent four people back, perhaps two more as we speak today. They've sent two to Algeria, two to Saudi Arabia, and two, I think, are going to go back to Somalia. Those are cleared people. They've been there 11 years. There's no reason they should have been there at all. We still have 158 people sitting at Guantanamo. So I think they are going to let a few more people out. Whether they start really letting out the mass of people that are from Yemen, or whether they're just going to give Yemen government money to build a Guantanamo in Yemen. We don't know the answer to that. My guess is it's a Guantanamo in Yemen. My guess is we're going to lower the numbers at Guantanamo, but it's painful because the president could have done this for the last 5 years. He could have started releasing people in the same way. He's starting to release them now. But it's as if people's lives are like a fly you kill on the wall. You know, he just didn't, and this government didn't care. So what's another year or two for these people who haven't seen their kids since they were 5 years old? What's another year for someone who hasn't seen their wife for 12 or 11 years? I mean, it's an outrage about the inhumanity of this country and a Guantanamo that's still going on. What's amazing to me is that even if they were able to get Guantanamo down or get most of the people out, which is not going to happen, I think, before Obama leaves the presidency, is they still believe they can put people in indefinite detention. That's become part of our governing system in this country, that you can pick people up, not charge and try them, and hold them basically forever. And that's what they're doing at Guantanamo, and of course they're doing it at Bagram as well. And I'm going to close this on a statement by a general who actually set up Guantanamo. General David Lenhart set it up. He was there for the first 6 months. He wrote an important editorial in the Detroit Free Press. The headline is, Guantanamo should be closed. But that's, okay, everybody says that. But what he says is something more deeply than that. He says it should have never been opened in the first place. He says it was opened as an interrogation camp. It wasn't because these guys were evil or bad or
dangerous.
It was because basically this country didn't know anything about the Arabic world, or not the Arabic, or the world of what they call terrorists. And they needed to just pick people up to find out about it and to send them back in as informants after they tortured them or threatened them or whatever else. He doesn't say all that, but that's essentially what he's saying. And we litigated these cases early on, the center and other people, about Guantanamo. And one of the things Justice O'Connor said in a very important decision in the Hamdi case was, yes, you can hold people pending the end of the, quote, war on terror. But if that war goes too long, it would be a problem because it's not like a regular war. But she says what you cannot do is pick people up for an interrogation camp to interrogate them. And so it's flatly against what the Supreme Court says. That's this General Lenhart says that's what the purpose of the camp was. And what I remember when I did the research on it back then, interrogation camps were outlawed because that's what the Germans set up during the Nazi period. They just picked people up on interrogation camps. So that's one thing General Lenhart says. The other thing he says that's incredibly important, and it's something I wish the powers that be in this country would learn, he says, look, you have to charge or try people. You just can't keep people forever without charging or trying. That's what our Constitution says. You have to take the risk with them, if you haven't charged or tried them, of letting them out. You can't just keep people forever. Of course, that's been fundamental, Michael, as you and
since
I discussed.
Magna Carta.
1215.
Right.
Coming up on the 800th anniversary. Not the first anniversary. 800th anniversary. So when you talk about the damage this country has done, not just to human beings, and I don't say not just lightly, it's destroyed lives, thousands of lives, millions perhaps all over the world in the last decade. But it's also destroyed any semblance that we have a legal system that has any kind of check on executive indefinite detention or executives doing whatever they want, whether they be kings, presidents, or whatever.
Michael, we've had a big breakthrough with the acceleration of the fracturing of support for Israel, with the American Studies Association coming out in support of an academic boycott of Israel and supporting BDS. Read some of the statement. It's really quite remarkable.
Right. It's supporting the boycott of Israeli academic institutions. The American Studies Association is 5,000 academics, and it's an extraordinary statement. And it's really, it made front page New York Times. It's really fractured. I mean, the BDS movement has been growing in strength. And of course, the academic one is the one that's the most vulnerable by people who say, well, I won't buy occupied territory products, but academics, that's terrible. But of course, as people, including our guest, Omar Barghouti, have pointed out, that these academic institutions are really part of the Israeli state and a propaganda arms of the Israeli state.
Yeah, it's important to keep in mind that this doesn't bar Israeli scholars from coming here and talking or lecturing or teaching or whatever. This is against an institution of the Israeli government that's complicit in the oppression of Palestinians. That's what they realize.
And I recommend this to every listener. You can go and look at it, the American Studies Association, and it's their resolution on the academic boycott of Israel. Now, first the cabinet, or whatever they call the ruling body, voted in favor of this. Then they gave it to all of their members. And the vote was what, Michael, do you recall?
It was about two-thirds.
Right. It was two-thirds, more than, roughly 2-1.
Yeah.
So it was an extraordinary vote. Michael and I will read you a couple of paragraphs. They go through, the first paragraph is about how they're devoted to the struggle against all forms of racism, including anti-Semitism, discrimination, etc. And then it says, whereas the United States plays a significant role in enabling the Israeli occupation of Palestine and the expansion of illegal settlements and the wall in violation of international law, as well as in supporting the systematic discrimination against Palestinians, is an opening paragraph. And the reason they do that is interesting, is important, because they're speaking around what the U.S. is doing. And because what you've seen is the opposition that comes out now to it is, why pick on Israel? Why don't you have something on China? And one of the answers to that, one of the answers is, this country is one of the main, if not the main, I'm not one of, it's the main enabler,
yeah,
of what's going on in the occupied territories, the discrimination within Israel, really the anti-Arabic sentiment, anti-Palestinian sentiment. And so they're going after it on that. I'm going to let Michael read the, not the whole thing, we won't read you, but I'll have him read the whereas clause.
Whereas the American Studies Association is dedicated to the right of students and scholars to pursue education and research without undue state interference, repression, and military violence, and in keeping with the spirit of its previous statements, supports the right of students and scholars to intellectual freedom and to political dissent as citizens and scholars. So that takes care of all the BS that we hear about, that it's against First Amendment rights. And another statement that's worth reading as well is that, whereas the American Studies Association is cognizant of Israel scholars and students who are critical of Israeli state policies and who support the international boycott, divestment, and sanctions, BDS movement, under conditions of isolations and threat of sanction.
What's great about doing this show with you, Michael, and in general, is I would not normally have looked up actually what the American Studies Association said. And it's incredibly moving. And if we want to give our listeners hope, you know, I admonish everybody, go read Ed Snowden's statement that he made to Brazil. Go read what the American Studies Association said about BDS. I mean, there's change going on now as we speak. And because Michael and I and Heidi do this radio show, we actually read the material that we normally just look at in the headlines. And it's exhilarating.
That's precisely the right word, Michael. I feel like twinkling.
Yeah. It's great. Well, thank you all our listeners for a great year with all of you. We'll probably broadcast once more before the New Year's. But it's been interesting and, you know, lots going on right now. So it's great to have you with us.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
recent article titled Overpolicing of America, attorney Chase Madar outlines the incredible overpolicing that has happened in the last decade but started many, many years ago. He includes narratives around the militarization of police, stop and frisks, students going into the school-to-prison pipeline, sex police, and similar over-policing activities. The pattern, Chase says, is clear. Who benefits is as well. And he also gives us the reasons why this over-policing is occurring. Today, we will look at over-policing in America with Chase, who is also the author of the book, The Passion of Bradley Manning. Chase, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Chase Madar, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Ed, great to be here.
Chase, you wrote a really important article, among many of the articles you write, but this one's called The Overpolicing of America, Police Overkill Has Entered the DNA of Social Policy. Can you tell us just what's the thesis of that piece? It's just something that new on the horizon. I haven't seen that statement before.
Well, I'm hoping this new term will enter the national lingo, over-policing. And what I wrote about isn't just the militarization of our local police forces with all kinds of military-grade equipment and returned soldiers, although that's a problem in itself. What I wrote about is the way that the police paradigm has just entered the DNA of social policy across the board in the United States. And matters that a generation ago would not require police or prosecutors or criminal law are now suddenly do. And that's in education, in immigration, in family law, even how we regulate the economy. All of these spheres, domains of everyday life are increasingly regulated by police and prosecutors, and you have this incredible overkill of police. And I think the only term you can use for this is a kind of creeping police state. I know many people may find that hyperbolic, but if we look at other police states in history, say the old East Germany, we find that the United States has an incarceration rate triple that of the old East Germany. And for black America, particularly black men, the incarceration rate in the United States today is about four times higher than it was in the Soviet Union at the height of the Gulag. So we need to take a very serious, sober look at how we are governing ourselves and how criminal law is displacing and devouring all other kinds of social regulation.
You begin your article saying that if all you got's a hammer, everything starts looking like a nail. And then you talk about the over-policing in, of all the tender places, in schools, in grade schools. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, you see this more and more, that disciplinary matters in schools gets outsourced to police departments. And, you know, to be sure, you have some failing schools in the United States. Most public of our public schools in the U.S. are doing reasonably well, but you do have a few failing schools. But the solution to fixing a failing school is not to send in the police. Where that leads to is these grotesque examples that make it on newspaper headlines a few times a year of six-year-olds, seven-year-olds getting arrested for just ordinary childlike misbehavior or getting led away in handcuffs by police personnel.
You have some in here in your article. Again, we're talking to Chase Madar, who wrote The Overpolicing of America. You have things like throwing peanuts on a bus, wrong color belt. I mean, is that serious?
These are, of course, not serious enough to warrant getting handcuffed in the school or for bringing in the police. And it will shock most of your listeners, especially of an older generation, who were not treated that way at their schools. I know I wasn't. But you know, police people are trained only to respond to crimes and to respond to everything as a crime. So that's just the nature of police. So when you send police into a school, the crime rate is going to skyrocket. And that's not because anything has changed necessarily in the school, but that's just how police respond to this. I mean, that's if all you've got is a hammer, then you're going to see nails everywhere. And if all you have are police and prosecutors, then sooner or later everything is going to be criminalized. And you also have the growing number of metal detectors in schools, even schools with terrific disciplinary records. This is an area where I've done a lot of firsthand research here in New York, and I found many schools in, you know, working class areas in the South Bronx that have, you know, high concentrations of kids living below the poverty line that do not have any of these and have succeeded at installing a good, orderly learning environment without police, without the metal detectors. So we know this can be done, okay? It's not like there aren't alternatives. But it seems like our political class doesn't want to know about these. For them, the model for our schools is more often the prison and how we can crack down harder, even though this is not good for learning or achieving good educational results, which, to my old-fashioned mind, is what a school is for.
Now, Chase, you've run through a number of the areas where over-criminalization, over-policing has taken place. And one of the ones that was interesting to me, they were all interesting, but is what you call over-criminalization at work. And what does that really mean?
Yeah, I mean, I go out on a limb here, and I'm trying to raise some hackles here. I think that even the way we regulate our economy is suffering from an overdose of criminal law and police powers. You hear about crime in the suites, and don't get me wrong, I hate our financial system just like pretty much everyone else in the country does. But what we have frequently is white-collar work getting criminalized by a mare's nest of criminal laws that are very complex, very difficult to understand, such that a great many people who are running honest businesses of any kind are going to be running afoul of the law without even knowing it. I mean, a few examples I give are the guy named George Norris, sentenced to 17 months in prison for selling orchids without filing the proper paperwork.
Oh, my gosh.
Judy Wilkinson, who runs a bridal shop in the state of Georgia, and she gets hauled away in handcuffs in front of all her customers because she's serving a few mimosas to her customers.
Well, those are pretty good examples.
I'll even go out on a limb and have some sympathy for the financial class devil here. I do think that our financial system is a mess and it needs to be restructured and fixed in many ways. But I don't think this can be achieved by criminal law, by prosecutions. I think too many people who are critical of our horrendous financial system just stop at demanding prosecutions. That alone is not going to do it. I think 99% of what led to the financial crash of 2008 was perfectly legal, and people need to recognize in a way the seriousness and the size of the problem. It's not like we have a great financial system that was abused by a few bad apples. We have a really crappy system that's legal because these people write the laws. And it's a systemic problem that requires restructuring and real changes of law. Just throwing cops and prosecutors at it, that may feel good, it may make good theater, it may promote a few district attorneys into political office, but it will not fix the problem.
You know, it reminds me of when they went after, quote, a few bad apples for Abu Ghraib torture, that somehow that was going to fix the problem. And what you say here is very clear. Instead of pushing a debate about how to restructure our predatory financial system, liberals in their focus on individual prosecutions are aping the punitive zeal of authoritarians. And I think that's really an important point, that it allows us to focus on these, quote, bad apples, when in fact the whole system needs to be restructured. I think it's a really strong point.
Yeah. So
thank you for that. And the other statistic in the next area that I looked at, I was shocked when I read this. That in 2002, there were 3,000 criminal prosecutions against immigrants for illegal entry. And now there are 48,000 a year. That's extraordinary. And what accounts for that shift?
The one thing where Democrats and Republicans can agree on is that, the way to get tough on immigration is by using criminal law. That maybe there will be some kind of amnesty for people here, but for people who are trying to come in, there will be a crackdown with severe criminal sanctions. Whereas before, it did not used to be as heavily laden with criminal law and policing approaches. Immigration law was mostly under the domain of administrative law with milder penalties, civil penalties. this is all part of a general trend, and 9/11 certainly intensified it, but it was certainly there before 9/11 with the war on crime and the war on drugs. These wars are no longer metaphorical. I mean, I think the war word is kind of a bland understatement for the kind of extreme police overkill that we are inflicting on the United States, particularly working class communities, particularly Black and Latino communities in the U.S. I mean, this, of course, does not affect all Americans equally. And one very smart law professor, James Forman Jr., wouldn't surprise me if you're familiar with his parents, he's written an excellent and very disturbing Law Review article about how the excesses of our war on terror, things like Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, this is simply the export of our everyday normal penal habits and criminal justice habits to more exotic, more visible venues. And we're kidding ourselves if we pretend that that's somehow aberrational, that that's somehow a break with American norms and habits, because we're doing things that look an awful lot like that routinely here, and it somehow doesn't arouse as much scandal. I think some of your listeners will be clued on to that. I mean, one question is, where does this over-policing come from? What are the causes of it? And, of course, one answer is that, well, it's always been here, particularly for Black America. Centuries of slavery, that's living in a police state. But you also have growing insecurity in the United States, growing economic insecurity over the past 35 years, the past generation. And although our political class seems incapable of doing anything constructive about it, they are very adept at channeling all fears about security in any sense into criminal law crackdowns and ratcheting up the police state to at least attack that kind of insecurity with everything the state has in its arsenal. And the result, of course, is not really greater security anymore so much as just a different layer of violent chaos that's enforced by the state.
We're speaking with Attorney Chase Madar, who wrote a very good article on Tom Dispatch about the police state, which has come, particularly since 9/11, to really envelop our institutions in the country. Talk to us about the sex police, Chase.
We're a puritanical nation. It's part of our history. But you have this incredible over-policing of sex and sex offender registries. You know, this is about the least popular group of any kind in the U.S., sex offenders. But I'm going to go out on a limb and point out that, all kinds of people get put on sex offender registries with catastrophic consequences for their lives. I mean, Human Rights Watch wrote a great report about juveniles who get put on sex offender registries. They get caught, say, at age 12 playing doctor with a cousin without anything serious, happening. Does the state and criminal law really need to get involved there? In California, the rate of individuals who are on the sex offender registry is just amazing. It's one in every 380 adults, and since 98% of those adults are men, that's about one in every 200 adult men in California is a registered sex offender. Now, we can talk about what the appropriate penalty is to, say, a 20-year-old who has sex with a 15-year-old. But should it really be wrecking that 20-year-old's life such that he's rendered virtually unemployable as a registered sex offender and such that any kind of life that he's likely to have in any kind of community is going to be extremely difficult? I don't think so. I think there's real overkill there. And there's a lot of writing about the over-policing of sex work, too, that instead of looking at this as another business or economic practice that should be regulated in a sensible way, gets the heavy hand of police power thrown at it all the time with results that don't work out very well for anyone concerned.
Chase, I want to end up on a question you addressed in the middle of this interview, which is the question of, are we a police state? And people's, aversion to thinking that because you think Nazi Germany, whatever. Give us your take on that again and what your thinking is, as well as you mentioned one of the reasons why we're moving in this direction, but you also talk about some blowback from foreign wars and some other things. And if you can just close on that sort of thought.
Yeah, I mean, the whole term police state, it sounds hyperbolic, it sounds paranoid. I don't think it entirely is. I choose my words carefully. You have more and more quite professorial lawyer types using this term, including the Republican appointee Judge Alex Kaczynski at the Ninth Circuit of the U.S. Court of Appeals, who wrote a great essay called "You're Probably a Federal Criminal," all about the morass of criminal laws that make virtually every American an easy target for law enforcement. The veteran defense lawyer Harvey Silverglade has written a fine book about how an average American professional can easily commit three felonies in a single day without knowing it. again, just look at the results. Our incarceration rate is three times higher than the old East Germany, and that speaks for itself. If our incarceration rate is triple that of an authoritarian state that no one would deny was a full-on police state, what does that make us? And I think we need to switch very swiftly to alternative ways of social policy in holding our society together, other than throwing cops and prosecutors at it. It's gone way too far. In fact, it's been too far for a long time. So it's high time to consider using another tool out of the toolbox than police.
Again, listeners, if you want to read this important article, The Over-Policing of America, it's on Tom Dispatch as well as HuffPost.
Stay tuned for my website in 2014.
We're looking forward to it, Chase. Again, thank you for this incredible article and interview.
Thanks so much, Chase.
Michael, great talking with you guys. Thanks
bye-bye.
So much.
Keep up the good work.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Law and Disorder is carried on many stations throughout the country, and we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge our sister stations.
Well, first of all, we have WBAI, New York City, 99.5 FM. WHYS, Eau Claire Community Radio in Wisconsin, 96.3 FM. KRFP, Free Radio Moscow at 92.5 FM, Moscow, Idaho.
WRFN, Nashville, Tennessee, Radio Free Nashville, 98.9 FM. KSOW, Cottage Grove, Oregon, 106.7 FM. WYAP, Clay, West Virginia, 101.7 FM.
KRFC, 88.9 FM, Fort Collins, Colorado. WRCT, 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. KWMD, 90.7, Kasilof, Alaska. 104.5 FM radio, Anchorage, Alaska.
WXOJLP, 103.3 FM, Northampton, Massachusetts. KEIF-FM, 104.7 FM, Enid, Oklahoma. 1640 AM, Front Royal, Virginia.
WPVM, 103.5 FM, Asheville, North Carolina. ISPCA Radio, Indiana. Online to Chicago, Oakland, Atlanta, Boston, Melbourne. Moton Community House Radio, online.
WPRR, 1680 AM, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS, 102.1 and 98.3 FM, Columbus Community Radio, Ohio.
KKFI, 90.1 FM in Kansas City, Missouri. Free Radio Santa Cruz. WSLRM-FM, 96.5, Sarasota, Florida.
KDX Internet Radio, KDX World Round Radio. AM 1680, Southwest, 13.560, shortwave. Lorraine Community College Radio, Cleveland, Ohio. WHUS 91.7 FM, Storrs, Connecticut.
WJFF Radio Catskill, New York, 90.5 FM. WDRT 91.9 FM, Viroqua, Wisconsin. WERU 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine. 99.0 FM, Bangor, Maine.
You were fishing in Viroqua. KMUD, Garberville, 91.1. KMUE, Eureka, 88.3. KLAI, Laytonville, 90.3. Shelter Cove, 99.5. Voice of Sacramento. Sacramento Community Radio, 88.7. MHC. WWPM, Media Network, Nokomis, Illinois.
Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR 92.1, Provincetown, Mass. WMHC 91.5 FM, Mount Holyoke College, South Hadley, Mass. KSER FM 90.7 FM, Everett, Washington.
WHUS 91.7 FM, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia 98. FM, Olympia, Washington. WCRS 98.3 and 102.1, Columbus, Ohio.
KSKQ 94.9, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU 90.7 FM, Illinois Central College, Peoria, Illinois. WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Green and Columbia Counties, New York.
KSVR 91.7, Skagit Valley Community Radio. KYRS 92.3, 89.9, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington. WQVR, The Eye, 1640 AM, Sandersdale, Southbridge, Mass.
WFTE FM 90.3 and 105.7, Scranton and Mount Cobb, Pennsylvania. WRFI 91.9, Watkins Glen, New York. WINO 89.9, Odessa, New York. 88.1, Ithaca, New York. WEFT 90.1, Champaign, Illinois.
Radio Phoenix Online Community Radio, Phoenix, Arizona. Boston Free Radio. Geneva Community Radio, your voice for many voices in the Finger Lakes.
KAOS Olympia, Washington, 89.3 FM. KWTF Sonoma County, California. Radio Free Kansas, Northeast Kansas.
KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland. 100.7 FM, Corvallis. 91.9 FM, Hood River. WSCA Portsmouth, New Hampshire, 106.1 FM. WZRD Chicago, Illinois, 88.3 FM. Thank you all.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.